And also for giving me the opportunity to tell you something about our results in Vienna. It's a great pleasure to be at a place where you don't need to excuse yourself for doing a foundation. This work will consist actually of two different parts. And these gentlemen were involved in this work. The Borivoj Dakić is a PhD student of mine. Johannes Kofler was a PhD in my group. Now he's a postdoc together with Anton Zeilinger in Vienna doing a BC experiment, the theory support. Tomasz Patrek was a postdoc in Vienna, now at the University of Singapore. Marcin Pawlowski is a regular visitor from the University of Gdańsk, and Milovan Shuvakov is a collaborator from the University of Belgrade. When I was preparing myself for this talk, I looked again at the, actually, the EPR paper, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen from 1935. And I remind myself actually that the dilemma they put in the abstract is still around us. And what is the meaning of a quantum state? So they provide us with two possible answers. One is either the description of reality given by the wave function in quantum mechanics is not complete, or these two quantities cannot have simultaneous reality. And it seems that this dilemma has not been resolved yet according to the different interpretations that we have of quantum states, and the fact that these different interpretations even use mutually exclusive concepts or philosophical backgrounds. Although I do think that this is not just a question of physics, that we do have still this interpretation, but also goes into the domain of psychosociology questions. So it seems that this is not the last version of the talk, which is a bad news, because I did make some changes. So I will try just to make a break of 1 minute to check this. So I have it on my stick, so sorry for that. So this is the question that divides the physicists basically in the supporter of two basic categories. One is an ontic view on quantum state, which roughly speaking, you can think about that wave function is like a mechanical variable, description of individual system of fields. You think about the wave function as something real out there. Epistemic view branches actually in two categories. And one of them is in which you think about the wave function as an agent knowledge of ontic states. So you think about the quantum states being a state of knowledge of some deeper reality, ontic states. But there is another subgroup of epistemic view, which is very often overlooked as being quite different from the first epistemic view. And this is the one in which you think about the quantum states as being a state of knowledge, but not about some deeper reality, but about future measurement outcomes. And I would like to argue that this epistemic view is closer to the ontic view, these two views, than with the first epistemic view, just for the reason that neither of them require any deeper level or more complete description of reality in terms of some hidden variable states. So I would like to call this other view probabilistic just to make a difference between these two epistemic views. Of course, each of these views has its own challenges or open questions. And this list of questions is by no means complete. And I also acknowledge the possibility that some of these questions have already been answered more or less successfully in some versions of these interpretations. But this is maybe the questions to which I would like to know the answers, at least by the end of this week. So one of the questions would be, within the ontic interpretation, what is the meaning of a complex multidimensional wave function? Chris talked about that yesterday. So this is certainly the issue. The other one, which is certainly a question for the ontic interpretation, is what is the meaning of a collapse of the wave function? Is it something which is instantaneous? Is it something which is random? Or there is a dynamical evolution of that? And the question of a collapse, of course, puts this is put in extreme in a case of the Bell-Pass situation, which you have two observers separated from each other. And you can think about the experiment in such a way that from one reference frame, you have a situation where L's choice of the measurement setting occurs before establishing a Dobbs outcome, but the same experiment from the other reference frame looks like that the Bob's choice of setting appears before its outcomes. So in any causal description in which you would require that there is some dynamical influence from one side or the other, the question is, of course, who really influenced whom, and of course, in which reference frame. You can, of course, deny to answer this question as non-physical, but then it's, of course, it's a little bit out of this framework. Why should you go for the ontic interpretation if you deny at some point that this is a physical question? The view that I personally support is a probabilistic interpretation, but I acknowledge that there are meaningful questions for this interpretation as well. And I would like to hear to quote Bell, who says, what exactly what exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of a measurer? Was the wave function of the world waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared? Or did he have to wait a little longer for some better qualified system with a PhD? Although you might refuse to think about the wave function of the world, the first question, what exactly qualifies some physical system to be a measure or measurement device, is a valid question. The main subject of this talk will be actually devoted to the questions we have for epistemic interpretation. So what is distributed here? What are states of some deeper reality? So far in the literature, all these states of some deeper reality actually the states of knowledge associated to real properties of quantum systems. And basically, we do speak about hidden variable program. That's a small cartoon that I like how this world should likely, in this interpretation, there is a complicated world for which only we have some partial knowledge, and we are just passive observer waiting to reveal the properties of the universe. Bell's theorem, of course, puts some restriction on the hidden variable program. And if we respect independence of experimental choice of measurement setting from the hidden variable, so if we speak about the freedom of choice in choosing the measurement settings, then the Bell's theorem tells us that local realism is excluded. We might ask, of course, further, but it seems that not possible to be the discussions of whether this is a locality or realism which has to be abandoned is experimentally not available. It cannot be decided. So it seems that there is an end of the road in this respect. Now, what you can, however, ask, and this is what my talk will be today, is how plausible is one or the other assumption. One question, possible question to ask is how plausible is realism in terms of the amount of resources it requires, or more precisely, in terms of the number of hidden variable states it requires. That was what was Terry asking in the last talk. Some partial results are known. Lucy and Hardy showed in 2004 that you need an infinite number of hidden variable states to describe all possible measurements, even for our simplest quantum systems of two-dimensional quantum systems, single qubit. Montina, who is, I think, next speaker, showed that in the limit of very large number of measurements, in certain sense, no realistic theory can describe nature more efficiently than the quantum theory itself. And this, I mean the following sense, that if you have a set of hidden variable states, then you need as many parameters to describe this set as the number of parameters you need to specify quantum states. So if you have a quantum state of dimension d, then in both cases you need d squared minus one parameters. But you can think about the cases with a finite number of measurements. The question posed by Terry and Harrigan was how does the minimal number of hidden variable states actually scale with the number of measurements n? Although it goes to infinity, as we know, and we also know how it should scale for the infinite, in the limit of very large number of measurements, for the finite number, it's an open question. You might ask, is it anything better than exponential function? So this is the one first question that I'm going to address. And the second one, how non-local is a non-local realistic theory? We do have a feeling that non-locality in terms of violation of Bell's inequality is in a certain sense weaker than no signal. But how weaker? And is it plausible to think about this non-local, non-locality? So let me go to the single qubit case. I will always represent my states in a Bloch vector representation. So it will be given as a vector in 3D. The probability to obtain the outcome I associated to some measurement direction, MI, will be given with this formula relating them basically through the scalar product. So imagine now that we have n possible measurement directions, M1 to MN. And given the state, we can have certain probability associated to these measurement directions. Now, what would be the hidden variable state? It should return a deterministic answer, either 1 or 0, to each of these possible measurement directions. It's obviously that if you have n measurement directions, all the total number of hidden variable states is 2 to the power of n. Now, in the hidden variable theory, you aim to represent your probability, a probability vector, associated to n measurements, as a classical mixture with these weights over some hidden variable states, OI. The natural question is, what is the minimal number of hidden variable states you need to represent all possible quantum states? So in that sense, we will speak about preparation universal models for a given set of n measurements. A useful theorem to answer this question is Karatedris theorem, which says that the point in a convex polytope in Rn can be written as a convex combination of always of n plus 1 vertices. So here is the model that give you the possibility exactly to represent your state, given state, one single state, in terms of n plus 1 hidden variable states. So what you have here are measurement directions. To these measurements, we associate certain quantum probabilities. And then we have a set of n plus one hidden variable states. So these rows are different hidden variable states. So if we want, and these states are populated with certain weights given here on the right-hand side. In order to recover, for example, probability distribution for the second direction, what we need is actually to add up only these two states with these two weights, and we see that, for example, P1 cancels out, and really the only what remains P2, what we really need. So what is important for this construction is, however, that these probabilities associated to measurement directions are put in the increasing order. In order, of course, that these quantities are positive. Now, you can go into the further compression beyond n plus, smaller than n plus one hidden variable states. In certain cases, for example, when some of the probabilities are the same, or one of them is just one minus the other one, because then the measurement direction, you can choose the antiparallel measurement directions that corresponds to the opposite results. So in certain cases, you can go below. You could think naively that this is the solution of our problem because we can apply this for every state. However, if you get another quantum state, you will get the probabilities that are not given in this increasing order. So in order to apply this, you would need somehow to permute some of these columns in order to get probabilities increasing order. But when you permute these columns, then you will get different hidden variable states. They are defined with these rows. And therefore, in basically for every quantum states, you will need to make this construction on another set of n plus one hidden variable states. So here's a very illustrative example, Speckenstein model, which is a simulation of six possible states that are eigenstates of three mutually complementary measurements. You can think about the spin along x, y, and z direction. The vertices, what I draw here is a polytop with vertices that corresponds to these six measurement directions. I draw a Bloch sphere around that, so this octahedron is embedded in the Bloch sphere. And what we can draw around the Bloch sphere is a cube. The cube actually represents now our hidden variable states, and the numbers, the components associated to these vertices are the measurement results 0 or 1 for x, y, and z measurements. Now, this particular picture and the Bloch sphere represents rather the probabilities for getting the plus result along x, y, and z direction than the mean values in the usual Bloch representation. So it's a little bit shifted a Bloch representation because we have probabilities. For example, if you think about the state associated to eigenvalue z plus along z directions, this can be written as a 50-50 mixture of two possible hidden variable states, these two states. So you have one half population of the other, and the first and the second one, and you see that the z measurement is always deterministic, the other two will be random. Now, you can think how, so you see that every of these single states need two vertices or two hidden variable states, and you can think how many altogether you need. And one very effective, efficient decomposition is actually to use the same vertices, the same hidden variable states for different quantum states, this one or this one. And in that way, you can come up only with four hidden variable states for these six quantum states. But if you go outside the tetrahedron, so you pick up some state on the Bloch sphere outside the tetrahedron, then obviously you need another hidden variable state. And if you want to incorporate all possible quantum states, you will need eight hidden variable states. So let's go now and try to generalize this. The generalization will be a hidden variable model based on so-called dual polytope. And you could see it already here because the cube is a dual polytope of the octahedron. Namely, let's assume that there is a measurement polytope, and I will also assume that whenever I have measurement directions M1, minus M1 is also a measurement direction, because we talk about the qubit, and this corresponds to two possible outcomes. So you build up on the top of this measurement polytope a dual polytope. A dual polytope is defined as all possible vectors wise from the three-dimensional space, such that the scalar product with each of these vertices of the measurement polytope is between -1 and 1. So basically, the projection to the measurement directions is always of rank 1. Now, any quantum states can be written as a mixture of vertices of a dual polytope. So it's an obvious fact that your Bloch vector or quantum states now can be written as a some classical mixture. But now these hidden variable states corresponds to the vectors that could be longer than quantum Bloch vectors. So they are somehow non-physical if you think about quantum states. But the mere definition of the dual polytopes guarantees that this probability, if defined in such a way, will be between 0 and 1. And how this probability is defined? This is the probability that the hidden variable O returns, this is the probability for the measurement result N O measured on the hidden variable state O. So it's a usual, so to say, borrowed from quantum mechanics expression for the probability distribution. And since this must always be satisfied, this will be between 0 and 1. Now, from that, it's obvious to come up to the probabilities for quantum states, which are classical mixture of these probabilities over the hidden variable states. And you can even show that easily that the sum over the possible results is 1, because to each measurement result mn, there is another which corresponds to minus mn. So summing up of the n, this goes to 0. So let us take a look on another example where you have n measurement directions associated to the cube. Let us build a dual polytope, which is now octahedron. They are dual to each other. It turns out that this octahedron these are the hidden variable states associated to the octahedron. You see that there are only 6 of them, which is certainly lower than the total number 2^4. So you need only 6 of them. Can we say something more general about the lower and upper bounds? Of course, the number of hidden variable states is scales as a number of vertices of a dual polytope, because these are the hidden variable states. But what can happen is that these vertices do not correspond to the deterministic answers. So it could be that vertices, again, are only probabilistic hidden variable states, giving only probabilities for the different measurement directions. In that case, then you can extend the number of, you can decompose these probabilistic hidden variable states into deterministic ones, just using what we have before, the application of a Carathéodorus theorem. And so I have to multiply every probabilistic, the number of probabilistic hidden variable states with this deterministic ones. Here we have n minus 2 instead of n plus 1, although I showed that n plus 1 is the number you need, is because every vertex of the dual polytope saturates at least 3 of the inequalities defining the polytope. So here these probabilities will be the same. And then therefore I can compress my decomposition such that only n minus 2 deterministic ones are enough. So if you look at literature in mathematics, you can find then how the number of vertices dual polytope actually scales. And there is a nice result from the 70s that a convex polytope with 2n vertices in R3 can have between n plus 1 and 4 times n minus 1. But the bottom line is basically the number of your hidden variables scales from between linear and quadratic number. So obviously, you can come to something which scales polynomial and better than exponential. Where do you expect to have a significant compression is if you think about the symmetric polytons. This we already showed in the case of a cube and octahedron. And you can use something about the group structure. First, that the measurement and dual polytope actually have the same group symmetry. And if you think about the y as a vertex of a dual polytope, and h of y as a hidden variable associated to this vertex, then you can apply the group element in a permutation representation to obtain all other hidden variable states. And if you do it and decompose the initial vertex into the deterministic hidden variable states, then the whole number of all deterministic hidden variable states is a union of group orbits, and therefore it cannot be smaller than the smallest orbit. So the number of hidden variable states is the minimal possible, is equivalent to the number of elements in the smallest orbit. So here are the examples for the highly symmetric platonic solids. So if you have a octahedron with three measurement directions, the total number of hidden variable states is equal to the minimal number. That's what we have shown. Already when you go into the cube case, you have some compression. In the case of icosahedron and dodecahedron, actually you have a significant compression. You see that this scales very exponentially with the number of measurement directions. However, only 24 hidden variable states are enough for all possible states. In this case, you end up with the largest orbit of 20 elements. In this case, you need two orbits, each of 12 elements, out of actually 60 possible rotations. You can go into the general case, and then, of course, you have, you can also, again, choose some Bloch vector representation. You can use, for example, generalized Gell-Mann operators that are chosen such that the Bloch vector is normalized for the quantum state. The quantum probability is given in a similar way, like in a qubit case. There are, of course, some surprises. For example, if M is a quantum state and you look at the anti-parallel minus M, if you plug here minus M, you can get a negative probability. So you know that when M is state, minus M is never a state. It's not that relevant for this construction. And then you can pick up the dual polytope. And dual polytope is now for the case where you have actually n possible measurements. N possible measurements, and each measurement gives you d possible outcomes. So you have the whole number of measurement directions, which goes from 1 to d times n. And you pick up the dual polytope as such vectors from r to d, that this probability is always between 0 and 1. So it's the same construction as in the qubit case. You can look at the same, actually, literature and find what is the upper bound on the number of vertices of this dual polytope. And you can even multiply this with the number you need for the category theory to obtain the deterministic hidden variable states. In both cases, however, what is important is the number of hidden variable states scales polynomially with n. This is, however, not efficient in terms of the dimension, because the dimension is in an exponent and remains in exponent. So it's n to the power of some dimension, which is d, is actually the d squared dimension of the quantum state. Now, in the limit of infinitely large number of measurements, we can actually recover the result of Montina. And then you not only have a preparation, universal preparation model, but also measurement universal model, because you cover all possible measurements by increasing their number. Now we work in a measurement polytope, which is built in a Hilbert-Schmidt space of Hermitian operators with unit trace. And measurement vertices at the measurement polytope are now projectors for n possible measurements, and each giving d of them, we have these projectors. And the dual polytope now contains of all operators such that the probability, like in a quantum case, this trace between, for the product of these operators is between 0 and 1. This dual polytope contains all possible quantum states, but it contains a little bit more, because for some projectors which are not among them, it could return, they could return a negative values. However, in the limit of infinitely many measurements, this requirement should be satisfied for all possible projectors, which means that there are eigenvalues between 0 and 1, and since they are of unit trace, we obtain all quantum states. Pictorially, you can think about this, that you have a Bloch sphere, then you have embedded in the Bloch sphere measurement polytope, and Bloch sphere is embedded further in the dual polytope. And when you increase the number of measurements, basically the dual polytope measurement polytopes tend to each other, and they actually touch the Bloch sphere. Now, again, you have not only that it is a polynomial scaling, it's actually linear scaling, because for every projector, we have a quantum state. This number of projectors scales as d times n, so it scales linearly with a number of measurements. So we have a model that recovers continuous result because the number of Hilden variable states scales as a number of quantum states. And again, then, if you want to parameterize them, you will need the same number of parameters. Now I'm turning to the second part of my talk, and this is the question, how non-local is a non-local hidden variable theory? I consider two distant parties, Alice and Bob, sharing some tangled state. Alice has a choice of a measurement setting X, observes an outcome A, and Bob can set the measurement setting Y and get the result B. Alice, for example, in the singlet, in the case when they measure, for example, the singlet, cannot control the outcome, but she can freely choose the setting. So the choice of a setting could be used to encode the information. Now, one could think that there are theories which would violate Bell inequality, but where the information that is non-local information that is necessary for the relation available on both sides is only a function of the outcome. This would be a nice feature of these theories, because although there is some kind of non-locality that is necessary, it's not a bad non-locality in the sense that you cannot signal. So Bob, not even having an access to some hidden mechanism, would not be able to read out the information sent by Alice, simply because the information contains only the information about the outcome, and this cannot be controlled by Alice, and therefore cannot be signaled. Now, what I'm going to show, actually, that this is not the case. So every hidden variable theory which simulates quantum mechanics in sense of violation of Bell inequalities is signaling, allows signaling at the hidden variable level. So what is a no-signaling condition at the level of observables of quantum probabilities? But this is simply that the probability for the outcome B on both sides actually depends only on his setting. So even if we write something as a dependence on an X setting, and we define this as a sum over Alice's outcomes for the set of measurements X and Y, this only depends on the local setting. So this is the well-known no-signaling condition that is satisfied by quantum mechanics and every no-signaling theory. But the question is, what if hidden probabilities exist and Bob has an access to them? Then a natural extension of this low signaling at that level would be to require that probability, now hidden probabilities, lambda, for the joint distribution of predeterminate results P1, P2, should not depend on the LS choice of setting. So these two probabilities must be the same. If this were not the case, just by Murr looking at these two probabilities, you can signal. It's interesting that here you do not require much. Basically, you don't say anything about the LS side. Only what you require that these are the probabilities, positive probabilities, which add up to one. So it's a kind of, if you long need to say, it's half of a realism, because only on one side you require. Sorry? It's P1 and P2. So it's a, so if you have a source and this distributes the possible outcomes for possible measurements, so Bob has an access and he can read simply P1, P2, what would be the results? No, he has a choice then to do what he wants. He can measure first or the second setting, but this is already determined what will be the answer. So he can, in a deterministic case, both results will be fixed. Sorry? Yeah, because in quantum mechanics, we do not have these probabilities at all. So this is something which is a quantum mechanical probability for only one observer. Sorry? Y is something which you can freely choose as an observer. But these are predetermined values. If I choose Y, no, if I choose Y is one equal to one, then I will read out this value. If I choose Y is equal to, then I will read this value. Yeah, but these are fixed. That's what is important for me. So what tells us the intuition about how the violation of Bell inequalities could be related to these hidden probabilities? Now, look at the Clausen-Hohn-Shimoni holder, one version of that, where you measure these correlation functions for four possible settings. Now, here is the way how to show that the information you could have about choice LS from looking at your predeterminate results on Bob's side are related to this inequality. Because if in an extreme case, which is not even achieved in quantum mechanics, but by Popescu-Rolle boxes, you could have the relation of four if you would have these outcomes, always such outcomes that A1, B1, and A1 and B2 are correlated, A2 and B1 are correlated, but only in the last case you have anticorrelations. So you see already here, and this is just loosely speaking, I will show next the proof, that if you look at B1 and B2, and if they are correlated, you will know that it is the first setting. If they are anticorrelated, it will be associated to the second setting. Now, it's interesting that for the derivation of Bell inequality from the no signaling at the HV level, which I'm gonna show in short, you don't need the full joint probabilities for these results. So what I will look at only on the correlations of B1 and B2 and at the hidden level. And secondly, what I want to say is that we assume always that Alice performed her measurement before. So she can choose either first or the second setting, and her result would be fixed. So these correlations could be written in that form, which means that she has chosen the setting one, and I can put these numbers, which are the same numbers, so I will not change these initial correlations. So what I will, at the end, compare are these two probabilities at the hidden level. So here is the proof. The proof says that Bell's violation implies signaling at the HV level, but I will prove this in an opposite way. So I will show that no signaling at the HV level implies that Bell's inequality is satisfied. So this is a purely mathematical identity, which for the AB being minus 1 and 1, you can plug in and play around and see that this is the same. And the second one is just a statement when you take a mean values of these products and the mean values of these ABs. It's, again, something which you can derive in a few lines. Now, instead, for the small a and b, I will put actually the values, which are the correlations between a and b1 and a and b2 with the index x, which is, will be free index, which could be either setting 1 or 2 for the L's. So when I plug this in this identity, I obtain something like that, actually exactly that. On the right-hand side, I obtain already the correlations that will enter CHS age inequality, but in the middle part is actually something which you might think about correlations between correlations. Why? Because you have this product and mean value between these products, and each product can be plus minus one. And therefore, it could be written as any correlations, as a probability for the result one minus probability for the result minus one. And again, since these two probabilities add up to one, you can put it as a 2 times probability for this correlation minus one. And this is what I will call epsilon x. This is the whole more proof, actually. Why? Because now I can use the right-hand side for the case when x is the first choice of the measurement setting. So I will have this on the right-hand side. And for the left-hand side, I will use when Alice chooses the second measurement setting. And now the no signaling condition on the level HV, on the HVR level, required that actually these two probabilities are the same, if you remember my last slide. So just last slide required that these two probabilities are the same. So these epsilons are actually just the function of these probabilities. So if I require that these two epsilons are the same, you obtain the CHS age inequality. So here I'm coming to my summary. What we could show that at most showed is that at most polynomial number in the poly n, where the n is number of measurements, are enough for the number of hidden variable states to simulate n measurements on an arbitrary quantum state. This is a significant compression with respect to the previous results. This is, of course, not our result. It was initiated by Hardy and Montina, but it contains a very important message that I would like to underline, that quantum mechanics is an optimal description in the limit. And even for a single qubit, realism as a hidden variable program, if you reduce this to a hidden variable program, is extremely resource demanding, requiring infinitely many hidden variable states. Second result is that any HV theory, while it invents inequalities, also allows supernormal signaling at the HV level. So for me, these two results are yet another indication that something, what quantum theory has telling us for 80 years, that there is a serious problem with naive realism. The reference I gave here does not contain the proof that I gave here, but it's very closely related to this. Namely, in this reference, we showed that if you want to have violation of Bell inequalities, then both the information about the setting and the information about outcome must be available on a distant place. And it's just a proof of existence that information about setting is necessary for the violation. But here, there's an explicit way in which way this setting information is available. So I will end with a quote that is very provocative. So Terry suggested me just to run away immediately when I put this quote. This is from the letter of Pauli to Born from 1954. So what Pauli wrote, against all the retrogressive endeavors, Bohm, Schrödinger, etc., and in some sense also Einstein, I'm sure that the statistical character of the psi function, and hence of nature's laws, on which you insisted from the very beginning against Schrödinger's resistance, will define the style of the laws at least for some centuries. It may be that later, e.g. in connection with the living processes, one will find something entirely new, but to dream of a way back to the classical style of Newton, Maxwell, and these are just dreams which these gentlemen are giving themselves up to, seems to me hopeless, groundless, bad taste. And we could add, it's not even a beautiful dream. So, thank you very much.
Just put back your previous slide with those points 1, 2, and 3 because I want to ask you a question about point 2. Now, quantum mechanics is an optimal description in some sense that because HP programs involve more resources. My question is, why is that a bad thing? The whole idea of a hidden variable model is that it gives us more information than does a quantum state. So, of course, a hidden variable state has more resources, it contains more information. That's a fact, but it's not a criticism of the hidden variable program.
It's not a big, a bad thing. I mean, it's the maximum what you can say once you face the situation that experimentally you cannot distinguish between realism and locality. Then you can ask some other questions. For example, the question about resources. If you think that it's not a big bad thing, I'm fine with this. I would not qualitatively say anything about it. It's just the cost you have to pay, nothing else. It says more about reality, which is not available to you.
I just make comment that you could flip that point number 3 around. Normally, you say you don't want superluminal signaling in order to prevent things like paradoxes. You could sort of flip the whole logical chain around and start from the premise that physics isn't going to give us paradoxes, and then from that, using this theorem, derive the fact that there must, if Bell's theorem is violated, there must be hidden variables that we, and that's the reason we can't measure them. The reason they're hidden is to prevent paradoxes.
Thanks.
Anthony Valentini. I'd like to comment particularly on you seem to be suggesting that if we have hidden variables, then there will be superluminal signaling at this deeper level, and therefore, because that's so bad, there can't be hidden variables. Something like that, okay? Now, there's going to be another conference in this very institute in November. I think it's called Gravity of the Lipschitz Point, where they're discussing a whole new class of high energy models of high energy physics in which at high energies it is, as they put it, deeply non-relativistic. And it's only in the infrared low energy limit that you recover Lorentz invariance. It's a speculative theory, but it's a theory that's being taken seriously by a lot of people in string theory and high energy physics. There are various other theories, for instance, in cosmology, in which in the early universe, at high energies, the speed of light is faster. What I want to say is that outside of the small field of quantum foundations, there are quite a number of people who are willing to consider the idea that Lorentz invariance could just be some emergent effective symmetry in some approximation, and there could be faster than light effects in a different regime. Now, I've always found this very odd, that it seems to me that in foundations of quantum mechanics, it's the area of physics where we have the strongest reasons to believe that there could be something superluminal or a breakdown of Lorentz invariants. And yet, in that area of physics, you tend to find people who take the take this view that, well, look, if it can't be Lorentz invariant, then it can't exist. So, I mean, it would be hard to imagine people in high-energy physics or cosmology, if they, for instance, had a problem with finding a Lorentz invariant theory of dark energy or you know, some issue in string theory, that they would conclude that, well, then we just have to abandon everything. We can't describe the universe. We can't describe high energy. There's no reality to the early expansion of the universe because we can't have a Lorentz invariant theory of it. I mean, why is Lorentz invariant considered so sacrosanct in this field that you think you'd rather abandon reality altogether to save it? And of course, what would that even mean if you don't, if you have no reality that's Lorentz invariant? I'm not sure what it even means anyway, but let's leave that aside.
So I'm not certain suggesting that that you should abandon program in which you are interested in. And so what the aim of this talk was just to show what the price is, and if the price for those who are interested in proceeding this program is low, they can proceed this. The fact with the Lorentz invariance is just that there is a, for me at least personally, was that one can think about something going faster, some phenomenon going faster than light velocity. But this is maybe put now to the extreme that these phenomena are sufficient enough that you can even signal, which was not obvious to me. I mean, you have, you know, in tunneling experiments, something which where the group velocity travels faster than the velocity of light, which is not a signal velocity. And here I thought that you could have some theories that you, where you transmit outcome, which is maybe travels faster than light, however, cannot be used for signaling. But it turns out that all this boils down to the signaling. My own research interest, and I intentionally didn't want to speak about that today, is not a hidden variable approach, but not for these reasons. I see let's say probabilistic view, which I mentioned before, as really an opening of new possibilities. Once abounding and going back in terms of Pauli, trying to, out of some reasonable assumption on probability distribution, on maybe limits of information carried by the quantum systems, the way to speak and to obtain, actually recover, reconstruct quantum theory without going into a deeper description of reality. And I think this is actually really interesting. Every probabilistic theory has puts something what was always possibly so far considered in physics, puts the observer as a participant of the world. And I think this is really fascinating. The mere choice, measurement choice of the observer is unavoidable in any probabilistic theory, not only quantum theory. So that's our reasons for me for abandoning this.
Steve Weinstein, I just wanted to point out, I don't want to pick on the superluminal signaling in particular, but your point three. Point three, which I was just looking at a second ago, it's too strong, really, the conclusion, and you set it.
It is.
You said as much in the beginning of your talk. Really, what you're assuming is, in other words, you can violate Bell's inequality with a violation of what you call the freedom of choice.
Yes.
If you assume that the detector settings are not independent of the hidden state, then three goes away. So you have no superluminal signaling. It's really a question, I think.
That's a very good question. Sorry, I don't know.
Just to sort of connect it back to the superluminal signaling, both kinds of theories, sort of a Bohm theory, which has signaling, and a in another kind of theory which violates this statistical independence are theories which have non-locality built in. One in superluminal signaling theory, it's built in into the dynamics, and in the other approach, it's built in some sense to the kinematics. So I think now it's true that you have to build it in somewhere, but that seems to be not too surprising. Any comments? My main remark was just that I thought the three was a bit too strong as a conclusion.
So you're addressing the point that there is actually the third assumption in the Bell's, in deriving Bell's inequalities, not only realism, locality, but the freedom of choice. Yes, I think we assumed here that freedom of choice.
I think there was an extra assumption, which is that Bob's device is responding to the hidden variable in the system right there. And it could be that if hidden variables are really a non-local thing, that but that's an invalid assumption. So to give you an example, if Alice's system, she measures first, has, you know, an entangled qubit pair, does the equivalent of Bob's measurement, and just sends, tells Bob's device, give out one or minus one, that's non-local. I mean, it has superluminal transmission, but there's nothing Alice can do to signal to Bob. The extra assumption you made was that that local variable, hidden variable, the non-local hidden variable still locally could decide Bob's measurement outcome projector. But that's quite a strong assumption, and that's, I mean, I just gave you a counterexample, you know, that you can have a non-local hidden variable theory which doesn't now.
You can have a hidden variable theory which will, for example, satisfy Bell inequalities. Or yes? And in which sense is the hidden variable model for the Bob? Because he has, so that it's, but there is something, nothing like predetermined values on Bob's side. So it's just,
Hans Westman. So I think this statement that you either have to give up realism or locality is a bit strange. If you read John Bell, so he's repeating over and over in the book that Copenhagen interpretation contains variables. These are the settings and these are the outcomes. These are vaguely specified and not precisely. But as he says, we have to do as best as we can with those rather ill-defined variables. Then with those things as lambdas and as your variables, he goes on in the first part of the theory of local variable to say quantum mechanics is not locally causal. And then after that comes the difficulties when he's trying to escape that conclusion. So regardless of different views, I mean, at least to John Bell, there was never any question of realism or locality, because even Copenhagen theory is a realistic theory, and it contains variables, and that thing is enough in order to get to a contradiction with locality.
I'm not sure that I follow. So here, what I use the realism is existence of joint probabilities for like non-commuting observables, for something more than in quantum theory. So maybe in some more general sense, real.
There is a first part of Bell's argument, mm-hmm. and that culminates in a section that is called quantum mechanics not locally causal. This is his motivation for considering hidden variables, because that conclusion might be avoided. But he doesn't have any stronger assumptions there. There's an assumption about what local causality means. This is what's called Bell local causality, or what people refer to as that. And also that you have variables, and Bell recognized that there are variables in the Copenhagen interpretation. So I would say that if one reads Bell's work carefully, and especially the later part of his work, the conclusion is much stronger. It's not realism or locality, because everybody assumes realism in the sense of tables and chairs and stuff like that, and that's the only thing you need. And
I certainly disagree that you or what you need for deriving the Bell's inequalities.
So I think it would be useful to when one makes these statements, to sort of make reference to Bell, saying he actually presents the discussion in a very different way.
So I would be very pleased for any discussion. I heard many times that Bell used only non-locality, or locality, sorry, without any realistic assumption, and I never understood that. I know for some attempts, which might not be relevant for you, that you use an EPR elements of reality and on the basis of perfect correlations, you establish elements of reality, like the EPR have done it, and on the basis of locality. But once you go from 2 to 3 particle case and have a GH set type of argument, you see that you cannot even establish consistently elements of reality on the basis of correlations and locality. And that's all what I could understand.
So I have a comment slash question, which I'm reluctant to ask because it might put you in a difficult position, but I ask it in the spirit of sort of consolidating what we know in the field and making the connections. So your theorem, your final theorem, strikes me to be the same theorem that Antony Valentini proved a few years ago. And so I thought I would ask Antony whether that's his impression as well.
So I thank you for the, I didn't know about this. So I also wondered, because it seems to be relatively easy to come to this conclusion. So I would like to. Okay, I didn't know that. We use here, however, the probabilistic theories as well.
I'll just add that in. Over the last few years, I've noticed that this same sort of theorem, if they are indeed all the same, and I think in most cases it's the same set of assumptions, determinism, a violation of Bell inequality, and assume you could have access to the hidden variables, has been rediscovered over and over again. And so just to tell you the other names, Eric Cavalcanti, who works with Howard Wiseman, talked about it at a PF workshop last year, and Michael Sievink, from Utrecht, talked about it here at PI last year. And I think Luis Massan has a paper which has proven it as well. So I think as a community, we should all sort of jump on board, you know, and of course, everybody who just rediscovers it independently has done something brilliant, but we sort of all need to remember this result and put it in the textbooks and stop reproving it.
Like